Here's a fairly recent poem. It will be published shortly. It's called TV Weatherman, and it's dedicated to Percy Saltzman. He draws his fronts with a stroke of chalk across the satellite face of North America. Makes a ballet out of highs and lows, giving swift shape to all the winds and clouds. No one below escapes. No one is left out. Black ghetto and white suburb, flaming Detroit and fuming Quebec, swept under the onrush of flood rain or snowstorm, or held sweltering in doldrums. The heat wave chorus in a 1,000-mile curve sweeps upstage from California, led by a spin of tornadoes, while in the wings of Hudson Bay, a band of cold furies is poised to wreak vengeance on the orange groves of Florida. Where now are the frontiers we defend? Where are the edges of our villages? Bold choreographer, be careful. Your dancing leaps across our loves and hates, ignores our barriers, making us doubt how long our walls will hold.
Welcome to the program, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're tuned into the Film, Literature, and the New World Order podcast for the month of June 2016. This is the 36th edition of this podcast, but I'm ashamed to admit the first to deal specifically with the subject of poetry and politics. So we are beginning that conversation with the poetry of F.R. Scott. And whether or not you are familiar with F.R. Scott, that I hope that poem serves as a nice entree into today's conversation about the nexus of poetry and politics. And I appreciate that poem because I think it's a nice and lighthearted way of examining the ways that poetry can wrench our understanding and perceptions and preconceptions of the world, in this case the way that we are locked into a geopolitical mindset that may or may not have anything to do with the way the world really is, depending on what perspective you have on it. So, for those of you who are not familiar with F.R. Scott, this is Francis Reginald Scott, born in 1899 in Quebec City, passed away in 1985, and in between those dates, he lived a pretty remarkable life, not only as a contributor to Canadian legal life, as a lawyer and legal scholar, as someone who had a profound influence on Canadian understanding of the Canadian Constitution, as a contributor to the political realm, and also as a poet. And just a taste of the remarkable accomplishments of that life can be summed up by saying that not only did he win the Canada Council Translation Prize for his translation of Quebec poetry in Poems of French Canada, not only did he win the Governor General's Award for his work as a social philosopher for Essays on the Constitution, Aspects of Canadian Law and Politics, but he also won a Governor General's Award for his collected poems, published in 1981, and we'll throw into that mix probably the most Canadian prize imaginable, the Molson Prize, which he received in 1967. Quite a remarkable life in many different ways, but perhaps most remarkable for the fact that he fathered today's guest, who will probably be familiar to a lot of my audience for his work on deep politics. I'm talking about Peter Dale Scott, who you will know, I'm sure, from such publications as The Road to 9/11, Wealth, Empire, and the Future of America, American War Machine, Deep Politics, The CIA's Global Drug Connection, and The Road to Afghanistan, The American Deep State, Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, or most recently, Dallas 63, the first deep state revolt against the White House. But today, he is wearing a different hat? Question mark? Talking about poetry and its relation to politics and deep politics. So let's welcome him on board. Peter Dale Scott, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
If you can speak, yes.
All right. Let's start today by talking about your relationship with your father. I'm not sure to what extent we can say your biography is, or any biography is, determined in advance by their parents, but obviously you did follow in certain footsteps that were similar to your father's. You, of course, have also worked in the political realm as a diplomat before becoming a professor of English and starting your work on poetry and deep politics. Talk to us a little bit about the influence that your father had on your early upbringing and your perception of the world.
Yes, well, it's ironic that in my early life, I had this idea that the one thing I really wanted to do was to do something that was different from my father. And so that's why I became a diplomat. He was never a diplomat. That didn't work out very well for me. I didn't belong inside the government. And so I ended up being a professor, dabbled in poetry, and also dabbled in politics. In other words, I became a kind of carbon copy of my father's career, with the difference that my father in Canada, he dabbled and was fighting the authorities. At the end of his life, he was a Canadian icon, and they celebrated his 70th anniversary with a big, and all kinds of people came, including Pierre Trudeau, the prime minister, who had been his student. I can't claim to have anything like that positioned in America, quite the opposite. But apart from that, our lives were quite similar, yes.
Well, it's a very interesting biography, and as I say, quite a storied one, and as you gesture towards there, certainly someone who was renowned in his time for his contributions to Canadian political life and thought and Canadian literature and
yes.
other fields. So let's... go ahead.
There's something neither you nor I mentioned about my father. You know, he for 17 years or so, he was involved with a Canadian political party that he helped create. It was then the CPF Confederation. It's still alive, and quite recently was the official opposition in Ottawa with a new name, the New Democratic Party. But he resigned from the party in 1950, and he was having a bit of a personal crisis at that time. And then he reinvented himself. He had always been a lawyer, and for 1 year he had practiced law. Most of his life he had been a professor of law. But then in the early 50s he rejoined the bar, and he took, I think, six civil rights cases and won five of them. And that may, in fact, be what he is most remembered for in Canada, because some of these were very important cases. And here, again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not competitive with him at all in that sphere.
Yes. Well, thank you for the differentiation. All right, let's jump into the conversation proper by examining another piece, which I think perhaps... similarly to TV Weatherman, takes a different perspective to wrench our consciousness and perception of events in a different way, but this one in a more serious manner. This one is called A Grain of Rice, and again we'll play from a reading which he conducted at SGW University, better known today as Concordia University, back in 1969, and we'll just start with the playing of that recording.
A Grain of Rice, a poem I wrote in Burma, thinking of the Korean War, seeing the monsoon rains, reflecting on man and the universe in which he lives. A grain of rice. Such majestic rhythms and such tiny disturbances. The rain of the monsoon falls, an inescapable treasure, hundreds of millions live only because of the certainty of this season, the turn of the wind. The frame of our human house rests on the motion of earth and of moon, the rise of continents, invasion of deserts, the erosion of hills, the capping of ice. Today, while Europe tilted, drying the Baltic, I read of a battle between brothers in anguish. A flag moved a mile. And today, from a curled leaf cocoon, in the course of its rhythm, I saw the break of a shell, the creation of a great Asian moth, radiant, fragile, incapable of not being born, and trembling to live its brief moment. Religions build walls round our love, and science is equal of truth and of error. Yet always we find such ordered purpose in cell and in galaxy, so great a glory in light thrust and mind range, such widening frontiers to draw out our longings. We grow to one world through enlargement of wonder.
All right. An extremely evocative poem. Such beautiful language. But I think, for myself, almost nothing that I have ever read has captured the senseless futility and heartbreak of the loss of life in war, as do those lines, "Today, while Europe tilted, drying the Baltic, I read of a battle between brothers in anguish. A flag moved a mile." It's just so heartbreaking, and so such a wonderful wrenching, again, of our perspective from our daily concerns to the bigger perspective of what is ultimately accomplished in such fights. Peter Dale Scott, your own thoughts on this poem and what it means for our perception of the world of politics.
Both the word perspective you just used is essential to them. And of course, I see this as a Canadian myself, even though I've lived many years here. But he felt Canada could only assert itself if it continued, as my grandfather had wanted, to be part of the British Empire. It would always be into Britain. And so he expanded, he became very interested in America and actually wrote for Foreign Affairs, I think, once. The way Canadian to be good and to be part of a much larger world, he wrote this poem. I don't know if you know this, he was in Burma. He was the technical assistance representative for UNAID in Burma, and that's why he was so impressed with the regularity of the monsoon. This monsoon is a storm, but it's a storm is the basis of order. So the lawyer here is writing a poem about the orderliness and laws that govern nature and make it possible to the control of chaos for us to live. It was done in a light way in the TV poem, but this poem, I think, is one of his really serious poems. It's not one of his most personal poems, but it when he says that what I would quote from is the very end, "Yet always we find such ordered purpose in cell and in galaxy, so great a glory in life thrust in mind rage, etc. We grow to one world through enlargement of wonder." I think that encapsulates both his ministry. He was a very devout. He was very happy to be working for the UN. It's one of his short poems, not one of his better poems, where he says, "The human race is my race. We can be best be by Canadians by being part of humanity, not part of the American system, not part of the British Empire. But to be Canadian, you can have the state order." And he worked for that in his politics. And he wrote about it in this poem and, in a sense, really in the TV poem as well. So as I recall, when his collected poems were put together, he was working with a Canadian poet. And I looked at it, and I seem to recall saying, "But Frank, where is a grain of rice? That's one of your poems." And if I'm right, I had a small stake in getting that book into the collective, where it certainly belongs, because this whole question of perspective, when he writes about the Laurentians, a lot of his early poems are about the Laurentian Shield, and what fascinates him about the Laurentian Shield is they're pre-Cambrian. They go back to the very earliest geological era that there is. And so that both in space and in time, Canada is like a small moment in a much larger pattern, which he likes to write about.
Let's explore the intersection of poetry and war specifically, since we're on the topic, not only because he wrote about it in his poetry, but also he reflected on it in a 1931 two-part article called New Poems for Old, which unfortunately I haven't been able to locate online in its entirety, but I have found an article that I'll include in the show notes for this podcast that quotes from that article at length, in which he writes about the so-called Great War. "The old order of politics needed no consideration. The fact of the war was proof enough of its obsolescence. The old order of deity was shown by anthropologists to be built not upon rock, but upon the sands of primitive social custom. Socialism and communism cast overwhelming doubt upon the value of the economic order. Psychologists unearthed buried portions of the temple of the mind. The universe itself, after Einstein's manipulations, ceased to be an easy movement of heavenly bodies through infinite space and became a closed continuum as warped as the mind of man. Morality disappeared in mere behavior. Amid the crash of systems, was romantic poetry to survive?" And he went on to write, "The modernist kicked poetry rather rudely out into the street to seek amongst the haunts and habits of living men for the stuff from which a vital and humane art might be created." Again, very evocative language, even in that prose, but I think it does gesture towards this sense of perspective that we're talking about here and how that was really wrenched by the flow of events in the 20th century, leading, of course, to the Great War and subsequently to World War II after the time frame in which he's writing this particular article, and how that called for a new perception of the world, generally speaking, I suppose, but also specifically a new way of representing that in poetry, which the modernist movement could be seen as a reaction to. How do you situate F.R. Scott's own poetry within that cultural conversation and social and historical context that was taking place in that era?
I hadn't thought about that article for a long time, but yes, it's very provocative. He was a scholar right after World War I, and it was there that he was introduced to the modernist poets. I think his first reaction in the 20s was more aesthetic rather than political. I felt his mission was to come back to Canada. He actually bought a lot of Ruskinite prints from the Pre-Raphaelites and so on, and he was going to civilize Canada aesthetically, the sort of way that Schiller hoped that mankind could be lifted up aesthetically. But then when you had the Depression, is what they think politically and to write the essay you just quoted from. And here, he was obsessed. We need something new. One of the things he did was actually work with about five or six other people to create a new political party. It's never been the government in Canada. It has been the government for 5 months. And it was a social democratic party. It's a kind of middle of the road between the status quo represented by William Lyon Mackenzie King, our longtime prime minister, we will maybe come back to, versus, on the other hand, the communists. And my father, I think, really was first and foremost a lawyer in his thinking, and he did not like the communists because he was very frightened of what the chaos of a revolution would bring in. He wanted something orderly, and as we see that in the grain of rice poem, the war he's talking about there, of course, is the Korean War. And as a Canadian, he's seeing it from afar as he saw World War One from afar. Less so in the case of World War One, because the state served, two were injured and the third was killed, and his father served as a chaplain, a padre, and he too was injured. But there's a kind of optimism in his poetry that you don't find in many European poets. I would contrast him with Czesław Miłosz, for example, who described himself really as a Manichean because he had seen such horrors in war. My father was never exposed to that kind of shock from war, and the result was he had an abiding optimism that we reason and law will make for a better order, and poetry supplies the imagination that will help us to grow to what
he believed in. Well, it's interesting in that context that he actually starts that reading that we're listening to samples of today in 1969 by noting that the readings that he's conducting during the course of that lecture span many decades and actually begin in the era where poetry actually rhymed. And he evoked quite a chuckle from the audience at that, because clearly there was quite a formal revolution in poetry from the beginning of his career to the end of his career, as I suppose there may be in every generation, but particularly so in the early 20th century. I think we did see an overturning of the old order, which F.R. Scott was not only part of, but also an observer and commentator on, wearing at least those two hats. Let's, as you brought up William Lyon Mackenzie King, let's turn to WLMK, which is part of the satirical poetry, which I think forms a core part, I want to say, of the F.R. Scott canon, although maybe not one that he himself was one to trumpet in his later years. As we were preparing for today's conversation, you noted that it was interesting, the selection of poems that he was reading from in that 1969 lecture, because they did not well encapsulate his satirical poetry, his political poetry. First of all, before we get into WLMK, what do you think is the reason for that? Why in his later years did he turn away from that canon?
Well, before we get to that, I'd like to make one comment about rhyme and form. I consider A Grain of Rice to be not only formal, but to even reflect a certain reading of chorus, because the first, there are three stanzas here, which are completely Horatian. You have three longest lines, and then you end with a phrase like the turn of the wind, the cap of ice, a flag moved a mile to live its brief moment. Those are Adonics. That's a Greek classical meter that was used in Latin as well. And it's not often that my father reflects poetry, but he does in this one. He's a very much, I think, always a melder of the old and the new, the conservative and the radical. In some ways, he was quite conservative, too. So the formalism of A Grain of Rice is important to me. And then, as you say, yes, I know that, because at the state, I know that over and over and over, the poems that are most anthologized are the political satires. We're about to read one of them. But he didn't read it in his poetry. You say it was 1969 you read these poems?
That's right, yes.
Well, as I said a bit earlier in the show, that he reinvented himself in the 1950s. He decided he did not want to be a political campaigner the way he had been before. And so he has cleansed his agenda, the audience at Sir George Williams College, of the political satires. But there are two of them. There's one of them gets into world anthologies, which we probably won't read. But William Lyon Mackenzie King, before I read it, let me explain to Americans who Mackenzie King was. He had a dramatic background. His grandfather had been a revolutionary in the early 19th century, William Lyon Mackenzie, who's a name in Canadian history. But William Lyon Mackenzie King, I think, worked for John D. Rockefeller before he came back and became the leader of the Liberal Party for 29 years. For 27 years, he was engaged in Canadian politics, and for 22 of those 27 years, he was the prime minister. There's been no other prime minister, except maybe the first, Sir John Macdonald, who came close to that kind of transformed the political system until in 1948 he was getting very old, and then in 1950 he died, and my father wrote this poem, and I put it on my glass, but this is what he had to say about Mackenzie King. WLMK, every Canadian would know what those initials stood for. How shall we speak of Canada, Mackenzie King dead? The mother's boy in the lonely room with his dog, his medium, he blunted us. We had no shape because he never took sides, and no sides. He never allowed them. He solely avoided what was wrong without saying what was right, and never let his, on the one hand, know his, on the other hand, the height of his ambition was to pile a parliamentary committee on a royal commission. To have the conscription if necessary, but not necessarily conscription, to let Parliament decide later. Postpone, abstain. Only one thread was certain. After World War I, business as usual. After World War II, orderly decontrol. Always he led us back to where we were before. He seemed to be in the cut. We had no center, no vision to pierce the smoke screen of his politics. Truly, he will be remembered, man, honor, ingenuity, ambiguity, inactivity, and political longevity. Let us raise up a temple to the cult of mediocrity, do nothing by halves, which can be done by quarters.
What a lovely line.
Now, there's some, the parts that get quoted out of the poem are light and satirical. There's more to this poem than satire. I'm going to have to do an on the one hand and on the other hand. On the one hand, my father really despaired. You know, you from what you quoted from the political essay, we need something new. We Mackenzie Cain was devoted to the annihilation of vision in politics and the defeat of anyone who risked carrying us off in some important new direction. But on the other hand, I think my father himself was saying, he's not just saying Canada would have been much better if we had had a Roosevelt, say, instead of Mackenzie King. He believed that. But on the other hand, he, I think, really believed that Canada had a Mackenzie King as prime minister because it was so divided between East, French and English, old English and new immigrants, that only a Mackenzie King could hold it together. And that's why I think there's only one quote, and I drew attention to the fact that it's a quote, conscription if necessary, but not necessarily conscription. Now, in World War I, when McCain was not the minister, we had somebody who wanted to bring Canada in behind the British as quickly as possible. And in Quebec City, where my father was a teenager at the time, the result was a week of rioting in which 60 people were killed. And my father lived in the rectory of his father, the chaplain in charge of St. Matthew's Rector Church. And from the rectory, he could look down and see the smoke and the shooting. And that, my mother always said, explained my father became a lawyer and believed in law. And in World War II, nobody wanted to see that happen again. And so all this thing about abstain, if there was ever an example of Mackenzie King's politics, it's the way he finessed the conscription issue. He did it right away, and he said, well, we'll have conscription, but nobody will have to go overseas. And the next thing was, well, they can fight in the Aleutians. And they actually did go to the Aleutians, and that was luckily for his kind of politics. The Japanese had already withdrawn from the Aleutians, so there were no casualties in the Aleutians. And then with D-Day, there was tremendous pressure. Oh, Troops had to go to Europe. And so in 1944, which is almost the end of the war, we finally had a conscription in which people went over to Europe. And I think only 700 of the conscripts were actually in active duty in the front line. And I think my father didn't disapprove of that. I think he was very glad we didn't have a repeat of the riots. So under the surface, which is, a satirical takedown of King, is a recognition that Canada has no accident that somebody like King was its prime minister for 22 years.
Well, you do raise, I think, what is the specter of the deep politics and poetry nexus by gesturing to the fact that, in fact, William Lyon Mackenzie King, yes, was in the gainful employ of the Rockefeller Foundation from 1914 to 1918 as the head of its new Department of Industrial Research, a period during which he was advising Rockefeller over such things as the Ludlow Massacre. And although that part of William Lyon Mackenzie King's biography probably did not jump out so much to people during that era, it certainly does from our perspective today, at least for myself, and given obviously the Rockefeller influence on the deep state and deep politics in general. So,
with the antitrust acts in America, people like J.P. Morgan incorporated companies like International Nickel in Canada to avoid the trust laws, and the Liberal Party, with Mackenzie King at its head, was really the party of those corporate creations that were Canadian in name, but American history of deep politics to Canada. And another deep political aspect of the Mackenzie King era is that the 20s were, of course, the era of prohibition. And America got a good percentage of its alcohol in those years, not the bathtub gin, but the imported alcohol. The House of Seagram, that was the Bronfman family, became the richest people in Canada and the richest supporters of the Liberal Party of Mackenzie King. So I'm not sure how much my father thought about deep politics, but I helped but think of those. You know, Samuel Bronfman, the richest man in America, had, I think, a brother-in-law who was killed in a shootout at the border. So, you know, they were trying to keep it legal. They would sell the liquor on a ship offshore America to a member of the mafia, or at the border to a member. No secret as to where fortunes were being made in Canada in the 1920s. It was being made from a traffic which was illegal in Canada, but it was in order.
Well, let's actually just pick up on that point, that your father's perception or lack of perception of the deep political nature of some of these connections, because it does speak to what I think is completely understandable. People of an earlier era would have obviously a quite different political perception and worldview than what we have today, given the benefit we have of researchers like yourself who have been piecing various things together. And as you say in the subhead of Dallas 63, the first deep state revolt against the White House, well, if that took place in 1963, then we could hardly expect people writing before that era to be cognizant of the real nature and power of the deep state. But obviously, this does impinge on even your father's biography when you look at it. Your father being a Rhodes Scholar, which, again, we now have access to the work of Carol Quigley and others to piece together who Rhodes really was and what his scholarship was really in furtherance of in terms of the Rhodes vision for the re-rise of the British Empire. On that aspect of your father, your father's biography.
Although my father, you know, his father was a devoted imperialist, really. He was also a poet, by the way, a published poet. My father was working really to soothe in the 30s. The empire had redefined itself as a Commonwealth of Nations, partly because they wanted to keep Ireland, definitely did not want to be part of the British Empire. They had very bad memories of the British Empire. But he also, another aspect to my father's of the Institute of Pacific Relations, which eventually came under the fire from McCarthy, Senator McCarthy, but at the time was kind of an American establishment effort to work out some kind of projection of American power into the Pacific Ocean and develop a working polity that would bring in China and Japan and so on. So my father, first of all, he got to know people in the American establishment, and he particularly the year that he had a Guggenheim, which we spent down in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he knew a lot of people in the faculty there. And as I say, he published in Foreign Affairs. To me, Foreign Affairs is the mouthpiece for the Council on Foreign Relations, which deep studied, and insofar as the deep state had a way of voicing its ideas in the 30s and 40s and 50s, it less so today, but in those years and today, that it was the deep state. The Council on Foreign Relations was the American deep state, and my father was publishing in it. So it got attacked by McCarthy, but it was the old establishment. My father would never get too far away from the right balance between order and change. And he was convinced that to have orderly change, you needed to have order. There's another event in his life which is more to consider. 1970 in Quebec, we did something called the Front Libération Québécois, the FLQ. It was blowing up mailboxes, and they actually settled at the stock exchange, which killed 27 people. And eventually, they kidnapped two people, one of them the British consul, the other one a provincial cabinet. And at this point, the negotiations broke down, the cabinet minister was murdered, and Pierre Trudeau was my father's law student. Was now the prime minister. He came down to Montreal and said to my father, what do we do? And my father said, invoke the War Measures Act. They created a suspension of law, rather like what happened in a lot of this country, except that in the case of Canada, it only lasted for a very few days, and in America, I'm afraid the suspension of law is still there. And my father, who had always been a civil libertarian, some people said, how could he have said that to Pierre Trudeau? None of my mother, because my mother, immediately they rounded up almost 500 French Canadian intellectuals, poets. My father knew some of them. My mother knew more of them. And all she could think of to just something like the conscription riots of 1916, and I think that's true. He did not want to see that, and he felt that to have orders and law, and law was if people were murdering and so on, terrorism. It was terrorism, though very small scale compared to what we've seen since. I think the main error was that they overestimated the size of the threat. And in retrospect, the War Measures Act seems like over. In fact, my father's party, the head of then by then, the NDP, he said, he criticized Trudeau. He said, you're using a mallet to smash a peanut.
What you've just said is mind-blowing to me, because I did not know that connection. I did not know that Pierre Trudeau was your father's student, and so I did not know that he advised on the invocation of the War Measures Act. So you are telling me that the foremost scholar on modern U.S. continuity of government operations and the ramifications for the potential implementation of martial law is, in fact, the son of the person who actually got that, in a sense, passed in Canada for at least a few days. That's a really interesting connection. Does that inform or influence your own study of U.S. continuity of government operations?
It certainly influenced my relationship with my father, because I was one of the people who disagreed with him. It didn't matter much, because I was here in Berkeley, but... And yet, I don't know that I am all that different from my father, really, because everything I've attributed to him as a belief, I believe myself. I'm very more different from I'm much more committed to nonviolence as an ideology than my father. I was part of it. Once we started having the weathermen and locally here in Berkeley overturning police cars and setting fire to them, comfortable being out there in the protests. The early stages of tear gas, I was prepared to throw the tear gas back at the police. The later stages, I went on both sides. I mean, the government's behavior was getting worse, but the anti-war movement's behavior was also getting worse. So in there, I always said I'm a Canadian, but on this show, I'll say I was my father's son. You have to have a balance between law and order. And, you know, some of the things that were said then were crazy. And that's why I didn't buy into Occupy, because as I looked at Occupy, it was the right thought, it was the right time, and in the early stages it was something that had to be done. But it sort of turned its back, I think, on the center, and was willing to go along with whoever turned up in the park. And those kind of people were never going to be the significant alternative that could change America. Someday we need something like Occupy that can reach to people who have jobs, who are working, and yet are ready at a crucial moment to put their bodies on the line. Occupy didn't reach those people, didn't try to reach those people. And the other thing, my other criticism of Occupy is but so nonviolent. I feel you have to have leadership in a movement, and you have to have leadership which imposes a discipline of nonviolence, which it can enforce with monitors. I was never arrested in the anti-war movement. I was a monitor over and over and over again. And I believe that there is a very fruitful tradition that immensely, because of the Vietnam War, is active now all over the world. You have peace enforcers of various descriptions in working teams. They tried to do it in the Sudan, although it was not very successful there. But the fact this is all new, it's all exciting, and people shouldn't think that American politics died with 9/11 and now we just have the forces of things. There, you'll never again see an anti-war that well organized to stop that, nip that in the bud. You have to organize differently. All I can say is there are people who are thinking about these problems and they're doing it. So I, like my father, am an optimist. And I can't say I'm an optimist every day of the week, but if you chart the American history, the Vietnam War was the war movement. There had never been anything like it before. And the Iraq anti-war movement, it failed to stop the war, but it come together quite quickly and create a powerful movement are still there. And I want to see the same kind of orderly movement towards the violent revolution.
Orderly decontrol? Oh, wait, no, that's a different concept. All right.
I accept.
Interesting. Well, I don't want to monopolize your time. And so, Professor Scott, I think we'll start wrapping up the conversation there, but not before we mention to the audience that this is obviously the connection of poetry and politics is something that you've thought about deeply personally through your own biography. And, of course, this is probably most something you've dealt with most visibly in coming to Jakarta, which former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Haas called the most important political poem to appear in the English language in a very long time, which is quite the praise. And I understand that you happen to be working on a manuscript for a book about poetry and terror, politics and poetics in coming to Jakarta, where you start off with, I think, the very interesting claim, whether or not this will prove to be my most important book, it is conceptually my most ambitious. By the device of contemplating my own poem, coming to Jakarta, I hope to deal at once with governmental violence, the response to it in poetry, the tendency of both individuals and societies to suppress truths that do not fit with received ideas, and the capability of poetry to help redress this tendency and also empower those important hopes that can reform the deep state. Quite an ambitious agenda, but certainly one that is quite relevant to today's conversation and I think to today's society at large. Can you tell us anything about this manuscript that you're working on and how it will help us to understand coming to Jakarta a little bit better?
Well, it's hard to describe the manuscript without describing the poem, because the poem was about the huge massacre in Indonesia in 1965, involvement not just in the massacre, but in the coup which led to, or the coup attempt, or the false flag drama of a coup attempt which led to the massacre. And I had written about it in prose, and that went nowhere, and I have almost a nervous breakdown. Let's call it a panic attack, but a very acute panic. I wrote this prose for years and years and years, and it doesn't affect anything. And then I just started to write a poem, and I didn't know what I was doing when I wrote the poem, but it's my best poem. I've been told over and over it's my best poem. It's actually part of a 3-volume trilogy, but it's the one that has the most energy because I'm so distraught. And in the course of writing the poem, I realized that I had to write about that massacre. And so there's quite a lot in the poem about history and Indonesian anthropology, Indonesian dancing and theater, but also quite a lot about myself. It's in the poem, it more and more became a blend of the personal and the political, a mishmash. I thought about everything, really, but then, no, it wasn't about everything, so I had to write 2 more volumes. But out of writing that, I began to see things about America that I had experienced in my own life, which I can honestly say my notion of deep politics came to me as a result of writing that poem, and came to me just about at the end of writing the poem, because I realized that I had been suppressing memories of things which were just too threatening to deal with. And in writing the poem, I recovered some, not all, but some of those memories. And then writing a prose book about the poem, I've recovered some more of those memories. And the poem is terrifying in a way, but, I mean, response to a terrifying experience. Prose, of course, is not going to be the same way. I believe that one reason we have banned politics is because of the way the university curriculum teaches politics in one place and ethics in another department and literature in another department and religious studies in another department, psychology in another, anthropology in another, economics in another. I really believe we have to think about all of those at once if we're going to find the right kind of politics to move forward and the right kind of just personal well-being to create and sustain that kind of politics. And I'm trying to do that in this prose book, which, by the way, has been very exciting for me to write.
Absolutely intriguing. And such an important point that you make there about the separation of various fields of research and inquiry in academia into these very stratified departments that must never meet. Whereas when you think about an event like the Great War, World War I, it's impossible to understand how that went on to shape society and society's comprehension of those events through the literature that represented those events, and how you can see the changing of poetry through the beginning beginning of the war to the end of the war, from patriotic poetry, die for king and country type of nonsense, into the bloody fields of World War One, fracturing those niceties of the poetry. That's an insight into the effect that had on society generally, and I think historians should be looking at that insight through the study of the literature of the period as just one example of the ways that these types of things intersect. So I think your point is extremely.
There have been a lot of books I've been able to consult, but I feel it was terrible for me to have that I'll minimize it, and it was a panic attack. But at the time, I sincerely believed I was going insane. And I had a friend, a close friend, who had just gone, two friends who had just gone insane. So it didn't seem impossible at all. Now, having had that experience, I feel a kinship with T.S. Eliot, who, you know, finished The Wasteland in an asylum. He had mental breakdown. The Peas and Cantos where Pound also went momentarily did go insane when they incarcerated him in the Peas and detention camp, and then they allowed him to write. I think that kind of crisis leads to a kind of seminal poetry. I see it in Miłosz. Czesław Miłosz is a great influence my film, and I love his poetry from right after World War II in the first book that he brought out after the war, where he too had been through, you know, he had physical destruction of the city of Warsaw while he was living in it. And most of us never have that kind of experience, and I think visibly it produced some of the greatest poetry of the 20th century. Herbert, too, lived through, speaking of Herbert, another Polish poet, also lived through these things, also a great poet because of the trauma. I have to say that one of the greatest novels of the 20th century for me is the Buru Quartet of novels written by Pramudia in Indonesia. He was 17 years a political prisoner, and he put this to, because of this episode that led to the massacre, and he converted that kind of trauma into an extraordinary series of books, The Buru Quartet. And I imagine most people in this audience haven't heard of him, but in Indonesia, they're living work, and more than one person has said, a major achievement of world literature in the 20th century.
Fascinating, and I must admit my own ignorance of that work, so I'm going to have some reading cut out for me in the weeks ahead. Thank you for the recommendation. So your advice to up-and-coming...
Yes, literature and politics, I strongly recommend...
Duly noted.
D-Y-A.
Okay. All right. So your advice to up-and-coming young poets is to insert yourselves into the most bloody, horrific situations imaginable and try not to go insane?
No. I don't know enough yet to... I'm working on it, but I have not yet reached the stage. I give advice to young poets. Rilke could do it when he was quite young himself, but no, I'm going to beg off that one.
Maybe when you're 100 or thereabouts. All right. Well, we look forward to that. All right, let's end this conversation at this point. I truly appreciate your insight and perspective on this, on your father's life, and taking the time to talk about this. It's truly fascinating and an informative conversation for myself, and I'm sure the listeners as well. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you. I always enjoy talking to you.